Session one, what we're going to do tonight is really prologue. We're talking about the history of Christianity. We'll really dive in next week. Actually, the first century is part of the history of Christianity, but that's all in your Bible. It's in the New Testament. And really, to kind of transition into the history of the church, you have to know a little bit about the major world streams that were flowing into this particular time period, which includes the Greek world, it includes the Roman world, and it includes, of course, the Hebrew nation, what was going on in Israel during the intertestamental period. A lot of this is referred to as intertestamental studies. In other words, the 400 years between Old Testament and New Testament. Again, we throw these numbers around like it's no big deal. The history of the United States is just a little bit more than half that, and 400 years passed between the end of the Old Testament and the birth of Christ. And so a lot of stuff takes place during that time period. We close the door on the Old Testament with the Persian Empire being the dominant force in the world. In Greece, it's mainly city-states. It's loosely affiliated city-states scattered all over the place. And we enter into the New Testament period with the Romans in power, and the whole world has changed. Everything is different. The Romans are in charge. The Israelites live in their land, but they live under the control and power of another empire. And so what happened in that 400-year time period is could fill up a whole other course. We could do a whole course on Greek history. We could do a whole course on Second Temple Judaism, which is the life of the Israelite people from the building of the Second Temple, the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, to the fall of the Second Temple in 70 AD. This course is a history of Christianity. So we're going to give a quick survey of all of those things in one session tonight. I'm going to introduce the Greek Empire. I'm going to let Garrett come and kind of talk about Rome. Have you got a chance to look through the notes yet? Through Rome and the Hebrew nation, and then I'll come back and kind of walk through the apostolic era, the first century church. So we're just going to walk through the notes. If you have those in hand, grab a copy. We'll start with the Greek world. So the politics of the Greek world, just a big picture history, 338 BC. This is well after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. The second temple is around 450, so we're 100 years plus after the building of the second temple. Philip of Macedon begins unifying all these Greek city-states into a single league. Sometimes you'll hear about the Corinthian League, and that is finally these Greek city-states coming together and representing a single political entity. Philip of Macedon, good leader, ended up dying. Really, the Corinthian League and the nation of Greece began its large-scale expansion under his successor, Alexander the Great. And that's the name most people connect with the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great spread, expanded the country's territory all the way to, did he get as far as Israel? As far as India even, yeah. And his big deal was the spread of Greek culture. He felt like, which is interesting, I think we have unintentionally had our own American version of Hellenism. Whenever you travel around the world and you see American film and movies and Levi's and, you know, English on the subway in Dubai or on the trains in Bangkok, and we've had our own version of spreading of American culture. It's kind of the same way for Greece, but in the case of the Greeks, it was forced. Alexander wanted to spread Greek culture everywhere around the Greek world, and when we refer to Hellenism, that's what it was. The spread of Greek literature and arts and philosophy and religion, and everybody should look like us, talk like us, think like us, because we are so advanced and we are better than everybody else. And so his conquest, at the heart of it, was his desire to spread Greek culture everywhere. This is important because when we get to first century Roman world, the world is going to be a whole lot smaller than it ever was at any point prior to that. Think about how much smaller the world is now because of language, because of communication, because of transportation, because of safety. All those are relative, but how much smaller is the world today than it was 100 years ago? It's the same kind of dynamic was operating during this time period, and it began because of the Greek Empire. And all of a sudden, this part of the world where people before would have spoken 20 or 30 or 50 different languages, people begin to be bilingual, and everybody's second language is Greek. And we can communicate. So Alexander the Great builds this gigantic empire and then dies at a very young age. And the problem was there wasn't any other leader charismatic enough or powerful enough to rule over that same size territory. And so his empire was divided up into individual smaller kingdoms. The ones that are predominant for biblical history, you'll see listed under the note at C. 323 BC, Alexander the Great dies. And the Egyptian part of his empire was reigned by a family referred to as the Ptolemies. The Syrian part of the empire was ruled by the Seleucids. And you also had Macedonia, you also had Greek proper. But for the nation of Israel, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids were important. If you think of your geography of the world, the Ptolemies are Egypt, which is directly to Israel's south. Syria is where modern-day Syria is, immediately to Israel's north. You see it referred to as the Arameans a lot in the Old Testament. That would be the area of Syria. And so these two, Seleucids and Ptolemies, would fight for the next 250 years over the land of Israel, the same way that Egypt and Babylon did throughout the Old Testament, the same way Egypt and Assyria did throughout the Old Testament. If you have a good Catholic Bible that has the Maccabees in it, you can read the Maccabees, and it will give you some history of the Jewish revolt against these Alexandrian rulers and ultimately winning their independence for a period of time. That's one of their big national moments of history. It also is where, whenever we celebrate Hanukkah, correct, is a celebration of the Jewish independence. I look at Ricky, if you don't know Ricky, because she's from Tel Aviv and she speaks Hebrew, and she's my local consultant on all things Jewish. So politically, that's the Greek Empire. All of those little areas systematically would be taken over by Rome in the first century. The Seleucid Empire first, Jerusalem by Pompey around 63-64, and then the Ptolemaic region last. And so Rome just kind of gradually in the first century BC extended, just kind of crept over and took over those areas. When you think about Greek culture under Hellenism, their religion, the pantheon of Greek gods, we know that, man, we probably know that best about all of Greek culture because of Percy Jackson books and movies, because of Clash of the Titans, because of, how many of you had to read Greek mythology when you're in school? What are the primary textbooks? Bullfinch's mythology is one, and then there's another one. Y'all are no help. What's that? The Iliad and the Odyssey are very good examples, yeah. But we're familiar with the pantheon of Greek gods. If you think about it, here's what the Greeks did with their religious system is not a whole lot different than most other pagan systems of religion. They were just much more refined, and Hellenism enabled them to do that. But they looked at the natural world around them, and they identified gods based on nature. We look at some nature religious systems, and they go to rivers and rocks and trees. The Greeks had lightning and the ocean and the underworld, and they identified gods based on nature, and then they would give these gods human characteristics. They would anthropomorphize their gods. And so if you read the Iliad and the Odyssey, for example, the gods, they seem like caricatures of us. At their best, they're just like a really, 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 Herculean humans. And at their worst, they're just really, really petulant, childish, foolish kids. They're humans on steroids. I mean, their personalities are exaggerated in all these different forms. And that's whenever we don't have any other place to look for gods, where do we look? We look at the created world around us, and we say, well, We'll find a God in the sun, or we'll find a God in the moon, or perhaps we'll find gods in ourselves at our very best and at our very worst. The Greeks did, a lot of other pagan religions did this exact same thing. They were just really good at it. And so that was their system of religion, and they spread it throughout the Hellenistic world. You see on B, two key ideals for Greek religion was moderation and knowledge or wisdom. I'll point out now, as we read through these philosophical developments, religious developments, what you'll notice is the thought world, beginning in Hellenistic Greece, is starting to become primed for this brand new revelation that Jesus is going to bring about a fulfillment of God's plan. They're going to start developing ideas like, I mean, moderation. That's a good Christian idea, right? None of us would take issue with that. You see, their motto there was nothing in excess. How many of you have heard people quote that thinking it was from the Bible? All things in moderation. I don't think that's in the Bible. That's good Greek religion. And knowledge and wisdom, know thyself. Understand thyself. Hey, if we could get that down today, self-awareness, that's what that's called, we would have gone a long ways in discipleship if we could just be aware of our own dysfunctions, our own challenges, our own fears, our own need for growth. If we could get that down, that'd be a big accomplishment. And so people were beginning to ask the right questions. Even if they didn't fully have all the answers yet, they're starting to think in these ways. In other words, the world is beginning to move towards this perfect moment, both in technology, in language, in culture, but also in thought. It's ripening for the time of Christ to come. Some key philosophical developments include the following. And granted, most all of these people had ideas and thoughts that don't have anything to do with Christianity, but I've just given you some key notes to think about. Pythagoras, for example, in the 500s, this is around the time, he's born around the time that Babylon is destroying Jerusalem. This is the exilic period. Pythagoras in Greece is trying to convince a bunch of Greeks who believe that that the world is, everything is made out of fire and water or land or whatever. He's trying to convince people that the universe is a disparity between cosmos or order and chaos. Well, that's interesting. That sounds like Genesis 1 through 11, if you came to that class back about a year ago. That's God giving order to creation and then the ark and the flood and God removing his hand and letting chaos return and then God remembering Noah and bringing order back in. That's order in Proverbs. That's order in covenant. That's order in chaos, this tension. Pythagoras is wondering about this over here in Greece. Meanwhile, the Hebrew people had that incorporated into their scriptures and their theology for at least 500 years and maybe a whole lot longer. Socrates, 469 to 399, this is during the building of the Second Temple. His search for knowledge led him to challenge the system of Greek gods and to champion ethical values that benefited the human soul. He was one of the first people in Greece to say that the human is made up of more than just physical, that there's a spirit or a soul here, and that the way we live our lives ethically has a bearing on the health and quality of our spirit. Well, that almost could preach, couldn't it? We could make a sermon out of that. And he was one of the first people to look at the pantheon of Greek gods and say, this just doesn't seem right. This seems... He's feeling around in the dark almost from a rational perspective, a philosophical perspective, at things that would be revealed later on. His student, Plato, believed in an ultimate God. Plato, of all of these, is probably the closest to a Christian philosopher that you'll find. Believed in an ultimate God, believed in the immortality of the soul, a perfected supernatural realm of which this world is a shadow. That was his word. Things here are shadows of the ideals that exist somewhere else. We're gonna get in Hebrews in a couple of weeks to this place where it talks, in fact, this week, where it talks about the tabernacle and the sanctuary and how it's just a shadow of the perfect sanctuary that stands in heaven where God's throne is. That's Platonic philosophy. And we don't ever make the connection. The need for one's immortal soul to escape one's imperfect physical being. Interesting. Aristotle, Plato's student, emphasis on the concrete world and scientific inquiry, God viewed in impersonal terms. Aristotle kind of pushes back a little bit. If there's a God, he may be there, but we can't really know him. That's the mantra of the agnostics. And you see also the Stoics that are going to factor in Rome. God is everywhere. All men are brothers. Chief value is self-control and duty. The Epicureans, chief goal in life is pleasure, not of the sort that we would equate with debauchery or hedonism, but of moderation and eliminating pain. You see at the end there, all these were searching for the purpose of life. I think you can see that all the writers, all the systems, they're searching for the purpose of life, doing so in the midst of cultures that had little to no moral foundation. They sought to maximize understanding and benefit from the physical world while also longing for a perfected spiritual realm. Answers were not always discovered, but this set the stage for answers that Jesus would give in due time. I think the connections between Greek philosophy and Christian theology are incredibly poignant, and they're helpful for me in trying to talk with people in non-churchy language, non-spiritual language, about why we believe what we believe. Now, granted, they didn't get all the way there, but these pictures are great examples of guys who were standing in the midst of a morally bankrupt society, pagan religious society, and actually looking around and saying, you know, this just doesn't seem right. This just doesn't make sense. What I'm hearing and what I'm seeing don't line up. And of course, in the case of Socrates, he was executed and put to death because he didn't get in line with traditional Greek thinking and Greek ideology. He was leading the youths astray, causing them to actually think, heaven forbid. But they were beginning to pave the intellectual road for what would come later on. You ready to go with Rome? You got a mic? Perfect. So that's the Greek world. First century, we begin losing the Greek Empire and transitioning to the Roman Empire.
All right. At a conference in a couple months ago, there was a conference over at HBU, and it was on the early church. And I presented a paper there called Of Greeks, Romans, and Jews, and it was various institutional forms and how they affected the development of the earliest church. So talking about Greeks, Romans, and Jews is extremely important because all three of these groups had massive influence on the formation of early Christianity. When you step back and you look and think about what was going on circa the first century, the Greek Empire had been gone for a while. After they had gotten conquered by the Romans in 146 at the Battle of Corinth, but yet their influence maintained. And it was amazing how that happened, because you think about the primary language of the New Testament. What was it? It was Greek. And it wasn't just Greek, because there's two kinds of Greek. There's something called Attic Greek. It's like the things we don't have around, the Attics. But it's actually, that's high-level Greek. That's elevated Greek. The New Testament was written in Koine Greek, which is everyday language. It would have a y'all in it, and so forth. But it's one of the two things the South has brought us, that and sweet tea. But one of the things that we see is that Greece had a massive influence on the formation of early Christianity in a cultural term. Because what Greece was doing is it still lingered. It's one of those things that it was always around. It was very powerful. But it could not eclipse the power that was getting ready to come and take it over. Now, granted, at that stage in Greek development, it was already on the down spiral or on the down slope, and the Romans just sort of came in and pushed them over. But once Rome got established, it was pretty amazing what happened. From 753 BC to about 476 AD, the Roman Empire existed. That's a really long time. And you think about how significant that is across the pattern of the world, the history of the world. The Roman Empire existed from 753 BC to AD 476. And that's really powerful because they were able to stand. And they didn't just exist in Rome. They exploded across the Mediterranean region. At one point, there were, we figure, about 90 million people that were a part of the Roman Empire. Now, we wouldn't say 90 million citizens because citizenship was very carefully given. To people. You had to either buy into it, you had to serve in the military, or you had to be born into it. Citizenship was powerful, though, because if you went into the middle of a village in Gaul, which was, and let's say it was sort of uncharted territory, in the middle of Gaul, and you were just a Roman citizen selling your wares on the back of a cart, and two Gaulians came up and killed you, and the word got back to Rome that that had happened, what would Rome do? What do you guys know? They would send the legion in on that town. And here's the thing. It only takes two or three towns for that to happen to before all the slow people catch up. And what would happen is people would catch on. They'd say, listen, there's something going on with Rome. They're powerful. They ruled their area with an iron fist. Now, and part of that is that Rome had three distinct kingdoms, or three distinct periods. This isn't really on the outline. This is some of my own stuff. If you want to write it down, you can. You had the ancient period. This is sort of the formation period, which went from 753 to 509 BC. So that's the ancient period, 753 to 509. The second period is the Republic, the Republican period, which is 509 to 27 BC. And if you guys have, you sort of, what happens here is this is sort of the rise of the Republican form of government. And what it was is you had the Senate, and the Senate was elected by the who, the people, the citizens, and they led that, the people. But yet at the head, there was still Caesar. But, and then in 27 BC all the way to 476 AD, that's the empire stage. You would go through some major lines of emperors. And often how an emperor, if you would come along the scene, how would you become emperor? You'd kill somebody. Yeah, you'd go up and you'd take them out. Now, Nero, the Neronic sort of that the lineage of Caesars gave way. And this is something that's really weird. There's a great year of history in 69 AD. And you can call it the year of the four emperors or the year of the four Caesars if you really wanted to. There are four guys that were contending for the seat of Rome. Ultimately, who takes it over? Well, the guy who comes in and takes it over is somebody who's very similar in terms of sort of his leadership, the way he was received, is Jesus, a guy named Vespasian. He brings in the Flavian dynasty. And it's a very different kind of thing. Out of the Flavian dynasty, some more stuff comes up. But right after that point, we see that this is the way that Rome is going. So you see, but returning to your outline, that they had developments in the engineering, the military. They created a highway system that made travel much easier. They revolutionized everything. On your course handout that we have, sort of the syllabus, one of the recommended readings for this stage is from, I believe, Michael Green. It was written back in the 70s. It's called Evangelism in the Early Church. His first chapter is on how Christ came at the precise moment he was supposed to come. Because if he'd come 100 years previous, he wouldn't have had the superhighway. If he had come 100 years later, he wouldn't have had Jerusalem. So imagine how close it had to be God sent Jesus at the precise moment. 40 years later, after the crucifixion, Jerusalem was in tatters. I mean, imagine how significant that is. But Rome became the biggest influence at the start of Western civilization. You take a Western civ course, we start with Rome because they were the guys that got it going. And what ended up happening is you see that they created a pantheon worship. Basically, they drew in a lot of what was going on in Greek, but they gave them cooler names. But then they also had, for a while, they had a little bit of diversity. What's interesting is Greece, ancient Greece, had more diversity in religious forms than Rome permitted, because at some point, what happens is the Caesar cult arises, and it becomes dedicated to Caesar. And there used to be a phrase in the Greek, it basically was Caesar is Lord. But for Christians, this is the earliest Christian confession was Jesu Christu Curio, which is Jesus Christ is Lord. And that it stood in exact opposition to the Greek form of, or the Latin form of that, which is Caesar is Lord. It's powerful how that works. But that's the influence that the Greeks had on the civilization that they were running. Basically, they were able to go throughout the entire Mediterranean. They conquered all the way up into England. You can go to England today, and you can find remnants of the wall, really at the skinny part, but remnants of the wall, because it's easier to build when there's not a lot of stuff in between you and the ocean. But you'll find some of that. If you remember the movie Gladiator, it's actually a fairly good depiction of what it was like in Rome during that time of Marcus Aurelius and what was going on, and a lot of the stuff that goes on with that. If you look down at point two, you see we'll pick up on these, and I want to spend a few moments on really on Second Temple Judaism. The universal language of Greece was spoken everywhere. They did begin bringing in Latin, but Latin doesn't really take hold until after the first century. And then you actually see in the history of Christian documents, you see Greek all the way through like the midpoint of the second century. Then everybody turns over to Latin, and it makes it harder to read. But one of the things that goes on with that is that you see the shift that's occurring. But you had road systems, the Pax Romana that went from 27 BC to about 180 AD. It's 206 years. It was the Peace of Rome. And that's where they instituted a massive quorum peace. Roman citizenship, you see that, unified religion, and the things that go on with that. But then we turn and we go down to the Hebrew nation. We go down to the group of people, what we would call Second Temple Judaism. And Second Temple Judaism basically exists from 515 BC to about AD 70. Now, why do we put AD 70 as the defining year that Second Temple Judaism ends? Because the Second Temple gets destroyed. And what happens is Judaism moves from the Second Temple period into the rabbinical period. There's a whole thing about Bar Kokhba that we'll get into later and his rebellion. But this is the Jewish people returning after their captivity in Babylon. As Dr. Laufer already mentioned, we're talking also about the realities of how, not just the Babylonian captivity, but how they come in and they're established through sort of a military reign, and they come in, and that's sort of Nehemiah and Ezra we're getting into. You see there in the outline Alexander the Great, as he defeated the Persians, the Jews were given more freedom, but this also led to the gradual influx of Hellenism. Hellenism is the syncretization, that is the blending of styles. You became less and less Jewish, and you became more and more like a Greek. This has happened, this syncretism has happened at a large scale within Judaism today. You see a very big revolt against this. If you go over to Israel or even in certain sections of like Miami, South Miami or up in New York City, where there's larger pockets of Jews that live there, you'll see this ultra-Orthodox reemergence of this happening. The guys wearing the specific clothing and all that. That goes on with that. as you see that there's some things that are going on, we're going to flip over to page 3. So if you want to head over to that way. In addition to the responses to Roman Hellenism, the development of the Greek religion led to 4 specific sects, which are the Pharisees. And this is the popular party. This was, as we have in the notes there, they were morally conservative, theologically liberal. The Sadducees, they were the aristocratic priestly group. Out of the Sadducees, you would get the temple leadership. Out of that temple leadership, you would get the high priest. We're going to talk about the high priest on Sunday, so you want to come back. And that's going to be fun. But then you'd also have the Essenes, that were a monastic, celibate, and highly esoteric community. The Essenes are a really interesting group of study that's going on right now because we keep finding parts of Qumran. The Qumran, knowing that the documents that come out of it. There's a great Bible teacher named Ray Vanderland, if you're ever familiar with him. He's always over there. He's got some really great stuff from the areas of Qumran. And there's a really big debate on what was really the influence. Was it the temple worship? Was it the diaspora Jews? Or was it this Essene community? Were the primary influences? You also have the Samaritans that were ethnically mixed. But among these, we see this is good in point E, 2 common tenets were ethical monotheism, the one God who requires proper behavior by his followers, and the eschatological hope that God would restore Israel in peace and justice. This is something that begins emerging. It was one of the unique facets of Jewish life. And one of the things that happens in this period, in the Second Temple period, it is a renaissance of literature. We have discovered through this period there is more people writing about more stuff that has to do with Judaism than in many of the other cultures that are surrounding. And we're finding more and more and more of it as we dig deeper and deeper and deeper. And there's some really powerful things that come out of that, how the influence went into with Christianity and what was going on. with that. So it was perhaps the greatest literary people in antiquity. What's interesting about this period is they never ruled themselves. They were always ruled by other people. And these other people would come in and they'd give them varying displays or varying abilities of how they could run and how they could operate and so forth. Second Temple Judaism is, in my opinion, the single greatest influence on early Christianity. And why do I say that? Because the first followers of Jesus were, majority of them were Jewish. Because they were the ones who Jesus had come within that community. Now what happens is, as Christianity continues to grow and to spread, Judaism is fairly isolated to sort of the Western Mediterranean area, the Eastern Mediterranean area. You've got a little bit of a pocket in Rome, you've got a pocket down in Alexandria, if you can imagine that sort of Mediterranean map. It really is that whole area from what is now modern-day Turkey and the seven churches of Asia Minor all the way down to what is currently Israel today, almost down to the Sinai Peninsula. That is where Judaism was. And in that way, they had a cultural influence there. That's where Christianity emerged. So the first followers are Jewish believers. There's a lot of things that we see out of that come into it. Ultimately, the Second Temple Judaism produces a religious state, not a civic state. The Jews are not given permission to lead themselves. All of the temple authorities, they're only over the religious functions of that day. That's why when they go to crucify Jesus, they can't do it themselves. They got to go to who? They got to go to Pilate, who's a Roman official in the area. Actually, it's a funny way that worked. But in the cultural trends, under point three there on page three, we see the diaspora or the dispersion. This is one of the more significant developments within Second Temple Judaism, because after the Babylonian captivity ends, not all the Jewish people return to the Palestinian or the Judean region. They stay spread across. And what emerges, and you see this at the end of Ezra, what emerges is a pocket of teaching that known as the synagogue. And the synagogue emerges in this time, and it's pretty powerful how that becomes the primary instructive tool. Your Pharisees weren't all located in Jerusalem. Pharisees might have been farmers in southwest Turkey, what we know as today as southwest Turkey, and they could have been leading the religious life in that community of that town, but then they would be called away for 3 months to go teach and to go lead things in the civic function in the temple. This is the way that it worked. For the dispersion, Jews without access to the synagogue or temple, the synagogue became the center of their religious life. When we step back and we look at the development of the early church, a lot of what we're doing even today with the role of the senior pastor and the pastors that help guide and lead our churches, alongside deacons, alongside people that serve in different functions, we go right back to the diaspora synagogue and the systems that they had for leadership. You had a group of people called elders, called presbyteros, that would lead that were specially recognized. But in the top of it was the monoepiscopos, that person that would lead over top of that assembly. We had that same tension, that we had that same system that we have here today within our local churches. So we see that Second Temple Judaism has a very significant influence. And now we're going to hop back into the apostolic era. So without further ado.
Catch your breath. You know, a couple of things that I found really interesting. If you look back on the Roman outline, if you have any familiarity at all with the Catholic Church, and you see under number one, small letter C, this is Roman pagan religion, was concerned with form over content. Formal liturgy played a very big role. The mediating role of the priest were very prevalent. They cared less about the content of what was doing. They cared very much about the form, the liturgy, the role of the priest. The emperor was referred to on B, if you look one up, was referred to as the Pontifex Maximus. He was that leader that joined civil rule and religious rule into a single person. And if you listen to the name Pontifex Maximus, you may not catch it, but that is where the title pontiff comes from, that the Catholic Church uses. It refers to the Pope. And so even before we get to Catholicism being present in Rome, you can see how Roman religion is going to kind of carve its own niche into Christianity whenever the two are put together later on. Just to reiterate what Garrett mentioned, this time in history, there's no other time at which Jesus could have come and which within 50 years he could live, do his ministry, send disciples. They could travel all over the known world, which was larger than it had been at any point previously. They could do so safely because there were militaries out on the roads. They could do so traveling conveniently on roads with inns, places to stay. If they had Roman citizenship, like Paul, there was a whole nother measure of safety just by being a citizen of Rome. And he's right. Within 40 years of Jesus' resurrection, the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed. The Christian community in Jerusalem is scattered. And the Christian church gradually becomes more and more Gentile as we move forward. The last section, when we think about the apostolic era, we call it that because it was the age of the apostles, the eyewitnesses of Jesus' ministry. And so this is basically the book of Acts. It's Acts, it's the letters. The church, the very first church was in Jerusalem. It was led by guys like Peter and John, and later on, James, the brother of Jesus. Their identity was predominantly, if not entirely, Jewish. But even there, not all the Jews were of the same sort. You had zealots, you had Hellenistic Jews, you had traditional Hebraic Jews. And so within the church, they were all Jews, but they still didn't see eye to eye. In fact, a lot of that early persecution, when you see Stephen being martyred, was traditional, not Messianic Jews, but traditional Judaistic Jews persecuting Hellenistic Jews, Jews that had embraced Hellenism. And so it was Jew persecuting Jew that forced the Hellenistic Jews out of Jerusalem, and by that mandated exit enabled guys like Philip and Paul and Barnabas and Peter to start spreading Christianity around the rest of the Roman world. The persecution sounded horrible, but it served a very practical function in getting the church out to Asia Minor, to Macedonia, to Greece, to Rome even. And so you can read through Acts. It starts very Jewish, and then it gradually begins filtering in Gentiles. The early church was very diverse in methodologies, political ideologies, ethnicities, and that was supposed to be its identity. It was a spiritual community. And as such, ethnicities, political affiliations, where your homeland, skin color, what language you spoke, none of that was supposed to matter. It's the spiritual belief in Jesus that binds us together. And when you think about that identity that was supposed to be present, and in some degree was present in the early church, and then you look at Christianity as it exists today, you know, a lot of times our greatest enemies are people that are also Christians that just think differently than we do, or they carry a different name than we do. We've really wandered far afield, but it's been a necessary wandering, as the whole tenure of Christian history will reveal. You see early identity there, the first ordinances, things like that. Turn to the back page. Number two, the ways the early church were viewed. In talking about the Hebrew nation, probably the early Christians would not have viewed themselves as distinct from Jews. They were mostly Jews. They still viewed themselves as Jewish. They just believed that they were Jewish people who were living in light of the Messiah that had come. On the other hand, those that did not believe Jesus was the Messiah looked at the Christian church. The Jews who did not believe in Jesus looked at the Christian church and viewed them as a sect that was teaching heresies and causing people to leave the faith. Put yourself in their shoes, in their position. I typically don't like naming names of other belief systems, but there's a sense in which the Latter-day Saints movement, this is how it was brought up. Joseph Smith looked around at the church and said, I don't think any of these churches are legitimate. The Christian church has been in hiding, and it's rising anew with me. And they branch off as people who claim to be under Jesus, believe in Jesus, although a new revelation from Jesus. And how does the rest of the Christian church look at the Church of Latter-day Saints? We might not even call them a sect within Christianity, but we sometimes refer to them as a cult. They teach things differently. There's some parallels between that dynamic and what was going on with Messianic Jews and traditional Jews. The interesting element, and the one that's important to pick up, is on C. The Romans really didn't care. What the Romans cared about was peace and order. And the Jewish people sometimes didn't do that very well. They only really cared about you if you were revolting, rebelling, causing problems. They viewed Christianity as a sect of Judaism, and the Jews had a lot of special privileges. Even with emperor worship, the Romans over time had learned that the Jews pretty much keep quiet and mind their own business unless we tell them they have to worship the emperor. Because they're monotheists and they believe only in worshiping the Lord, we tell them they have to worship Caesar, they blow a gasket, and we have a problem on our hands. And so Rome had made an exception for the Jews, and as long as Christianity was viewed under the umbrella of Judaism, that same exception was extended to them. But over time, more and more Gentiles start entering into the Christian church, and the distinction between Christianity and Judaism starts to become a little bit more pronounced. And what led to the destruction of the temple in 70 was yet another Jewish uprising, revolting and rebelling against Rome. And when they're doing that, and Rome is sending legions on Jerusalem, a lot of the Christians, especially the Gentile Christians, are saying, we don't have a dog in this fight. We're not standing for Jewish nationalism, and we don't really want to put our necks on the line to fight Israel's battle. And so the Christians kind of started backing up and distancing themselves from Judaism. And as those two elements started creeping in, it became easier and easier for Rome to look at Christians like everybody else in the Roman Empire except Jews. And when that happened, they're expected to participate in the social life of the Roman Empire and to acknowledge the Emperor of Rome as a deity. And then when Christians refuse to acknowledge Caesar as God and refuse to participate in some of the social life of Rome that was connected to pagan worship, then what happens? That's when the persecutions begin. Now, that's as long as they were under the umbrella of Judaism, they were safe, except for the kinds of persecutions the Jews brought on themselves. Once they got pushed outside the umbrella, then problems began to happen. And you see, a couple of those are described very briefly at the end. The two chief Roman emperors that were known for persecuting Christians were Nero around 64 and Domitian around 96. For all the commentary about Christian persecution, most of what we know from the records was localized in Rome. Maybe some of it outside in Asia Minor, but most of it was predominantly in the city of Rome, and most of it was under these two guys. There were emperors in between that were content to let the Jews and the Christians do what they wanted. But these two guys had, for different reasons, kind of landed on Christians. Nero was accused of burning Rome, burning the city, and he needed a scapegoat. And so he found one in the Christians and the Jews. It was most likely under Nero's persecution. Church tradition would suggest that that's when Peter was martyred and when Paul was martyred. We don't know that for sure, but that's where church tradition would indicate that both of them were killed. Domitian was trying to revive some traditional Roman pagan ideologies. And because there was no longer a temple in Jerusalem for the Jews to pay temple taxes, he said, well, you should just keep paying your temple taxes to Rome. Pay them to us. And tagged the Christians in on that. And so that caused the Jews and Christians both to refuse to pay temple tax to Rome and rise up, and that ushered in a whole other set of persecutions. The persecutions in the first century were horrible, but they were limited to the city of Rome and really to these two guys' brief reigns. We'll get more persecutions later on, but for the first century, this really... The second one, by the way, we have Peter and Paul probably connected to the persecutions of Nero. The persecutions of Domitian during that last decade probably is the backdrop for John's visions that are communicated in the Revelation. And when he's talking about beasts and Babylon and the city on seven hills, He's got Rome as the enemy persecuting the Christian church under Domitian's reign as the immediate backdrop for the message that he was giving there. All this is interesting. I think that if all you needed was the Bible says this Jesus is the Son of God and this was the appointed time, a lot of people will just believe that. But if you need further evidence, if you're looking for more reason to believe, you look at all of these streams kind of flowing from different places and different times and different cultures all to a crossroads right at a perfect point in philosophy, in religion, in technology, in engineering, in military, in language, in culture, all flowing from different places and landing in just this little window before it's going to explode again. We get too far past Rome, and all of a sudden we move into Middle Ages and Dark Ages and things like that. This little window of time, Jesus could not have been born and executed his ministry at a better time anywhere in the history of humanity other than maybe today for the ease and the speed of his message and his church spreading throughout the known world. It's really remarkable. There's a lot. I mean, even within what we know, there's church tradition that says that Thomas went to India and spread the church into South Asia, that James perhaps went into Spain, moving it to the very far edges of Europe. I mean, that generation of eyewitnesses to Jesus and his ministry took the gospel even beyond the Roman Empire to places at the very edges of the known world. And so it really is, from a historical point of view, it really is remarkable. And to me, it lends even more reason to believe. I mean, is it just by chance that all happened at this time? It lends greater validity to thinking that maybe Jesus being born, a carpenter in a no-name town, in a no-name country, in a no-name part of the Roman Empire, would have this kind of an influence. It couldn't have happened at any other time. It was perfect. Yeah. Yeah. And roads and common language, I mean, honestly, if you think about the modern missionary movement, it began centuries ago, but the modern missionary movement in the last 100 years has grown faster probably than any other time in human history. And what do you see in common there? It's not a common language, but English is spoken in more parts of the world than any other language has been at any other point in human history. And air travel has made the world even smaller than Roman roads were. It's the same effect, just instead of an empire-wide scale, it's a global scale. Very, very interesting.